Welcome back to American Warrior Radio, ladies and gentlemen. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. As you know, here on American Warrior Radio, we talk about the men and women who protect us both abroad and on the home front. And I will confess, I have been missing a very, very critical category, but we're going to fix that today. I like to call them angels with rotors. I don't know if that's flattering or not, or even an accurate depiction, but we're joined now by Beth Ann Laus. Beth is a woman who's spent much of her career as one of those angels with rotors, as a, and I'm going to tell you, Beth Ann, let me, right off the bat, I'm not quite sure what the proper term for this is. Is it flight nurse? Is it, what did you call what you do?
It's flight nurse, and thank you for having me today. I appreciate that. It is flight nurse, and or life flight nurse, and it is a profession that is so exciting. Just love it. You know, it's been good to me. It was great to me. And I was a life flight nurse for 8 years and working in Tucson full time during that time. And exciting, and what drew me to it was going through school. You either decide you want to go into management or you want to do patient care, but I wanted to fly. And that was my draw.
So tell us, I think, well, anybody who's been in a, well, let me back up a little, sort of, you know, Ben gets dumb questions every show. I'm going to have a lot of dumb questions now because I literally live very close to a trauma center. So I see the birds going over, unfortunately, more than I'd like, probably, for the sake of those people. But I don't really know that much about it. I'm very familiar with, when you talk about the PJs and the flight medics and the military. But to be honest with you, I never gave much thought to those of you who do it on the civilian side. So what, in addition to, I mean, your degree, you've got a nursing degree, correct?
That's correct. I actually have 4 degrees.
Okay.
Yes. And so I have a nursing degree. I have a degree in psychology. I have a master's in healthcare management. And then I have a liberal arts degree. So 2 bachelors.
So if you, well, about halfway through that mass of degrees, if you wanted to be a flight nurse, what additional, I mean, that'll just take any old nurse and plunk them on a helicopter or a plane, right? I mean, there's got to be some additional specialty training or skills.
Absolutely. They require you to have about 5 to 10 years of critical care nursing. So you have to have your critical care nursing certification. You have to have your advanced cardiac life support certification. You have to have your pediatric advanced life support education. And then they also require you to be an advanced practice nurse. Now, when I did this, when I actually was a flight nurse, I was taken under the wing of a mentor. So they gave me a pass on the 5 to 10 years. Back then it was only like more like 2 to 3, and I already had that. I was an LPN prior to becoming an RN, so I was working in CCU prior to that time, and they counted that. And so when I decided to go ahead and go forward with it, I didn't do the typical route. I had my initial degrees, my nursing degree and my psychology degree, but then I was hired by American Airlines. And they took me on as a flight nurse for long-term medical transport overseas. And so I went and did the training program. I became a flight attendant, did not work as a flight attendant, but became a flight nurse for them. It's mandatory you do both. And that was 12 weeks.
I'm glad you brought that up because very often, at least I thought about flight nurses in the context of the helicopters. There's a bad accident somewhere in the mountains. We need to get someone back to the hospital right away. But you bring up a good point. There's lots of other situations where they're transporting patients and they're not just going to plunk them, you know, in coach in the back seat if they got special needs, right?
No, they're not. And American Airlines had a unique program back, like I said, back in 92-ish. And that program, they only picked the very best. It was a really difficult opportunity. I mean, it was a great opportunity, but a difficult chance, and you had to perform. You had to be one of their top performers. Your memory had to be excellent because they had just extreme, well, besides your flying, you know, you have to have extreme degrees and education and confidence in yourself. And I got hired. I was really proud. I was young, very young, and I got hired to do that. Now, the flip side of the story is I did 3 flights overseas, and both were very long. One was an 8-hour, one was a 12-hour, one was almost a 22-hour flight overseas. I decided after those 3 flights it was not for me, and it was just too much up in the air. I wasn't the best, most comfortable flyer. And so I resigned from doing that, and I came back to Tucson because I was actually stationed out of Dallas. And I came back to Tucson and decided to be a life flight nurse here locally, both sharing trauma call between TMC and UMC.
Now, so in the more traditional life flight nurse role that you're in now in this part of your life, what is the loadout on those birds? Is it, I mean, clearly there's a pilot. How many other personnel are on a normal flight, if there is such a thing?
Well, it's, first of all, the helicopter is extremely cramped. There's no room. There's very little room when you, so to answer your question, there are three of us, and then the patient. And so it would be the pilot, myself, either another nurse or a paramedic and EMT, and then the patient. And the patient and pilot ride in the front. The patient rides to the left, pilot to the right, generally speaking. Sometimes that can be flipped. And then you have us in the back. And when I say back, it's like right on top of, you know, the pilot and the patient.
Would it be like, if I were to imagine, as I picture the back of an ambulance or a paramedic vehicle, is it kind of like that? Or, I mean, just because of weight, you can't carry all that stuff?
Well, okay, so it does have quite a bit of equipment on it, but it's, you know, everything's confined. You don't have any room to basically, you know, switch seats or move around, very little. But the nurse, though, is always behind the patient, taking care of the patient, responding to the patient's needs, monitoring the patient. And, you know, and plus, on top of it, it's extremely loud in
sure,
there.
Sure.
You cannot just have a general conversation. So it's very difficult to hear. Everyone has headsets on. And so you're having to watch, not almost like it's body language. You're definitely watching the body language of the patient. You're watching the body language of the pilot. And you're watching the body language of your team member. And that team, your team, is critical. It is, you have to be a tight team to understand each other, how you're working together.
So you mentioned you have a psychology degree. In prepping for this show, I learned that it's not, I mean, clearly someone's, they've had some kind of trauma, so there's the emergency medical portion of this. But so often, particularly with younger patients, if they're conscious, they're scared too. And is part of your job also trying to keep them not only alive, but as calm as possible? And how, you mentioned the headphones, I was thinking, you know, how on earth do you do that in a helicopter?
Well, the patient also has headphones on if that's possible,
okay.
Because it's very loud for them as well. So, you know, and we're trying to relax them. Often we're giving, you know, morphine or Demerol to if they're in pain or if they've had broken bones or definite trauma. So we're doing this, you know, excuse the expression, but that's the first thing that comes to my mind is a tin sardine can. It's very small and it's very loud and no room. And so the patient sees out the window if they're alert and oriented or not, but their view is out the window. So they're also seeing what the pilot's seeing. So it's kind of an obtuse, unusual point of view for them. They see where we're flying. We're behind in the back doing all what we need to be doing to keep that patient stable, calm, and comfortable.
When you are called, and you said that sometimes you're making up to three to six flights per shift.
Well, it depends. Now, back when I first started, we were doing 24-hour shifts, and then we would have sleep time in between. And now it's more 12-hour shifts, and so those, it would be maybe two calls on a 12-hour shift. But when we start in, say, the beginning of our shift, we have to get our report, we have to do our flight checks, we have to stock the helicopter. We have to make sure that we have all the equipment necessary to take care of an ICU or critical care patient. And so it's not just, you know, going on that transport. And not every transport is a critical case. Sometimes we'll transfer a patient from point A to point B and the patient's stabilized, but they're going to go have surgery. So it's not always, you know, trauma care. You know, sometimes it is. It just depends on those types of calls. But the one thing that also, we have downtime too. So when we have downtime, you know, we are able to go walk around the hospital, have some rest time. But when you're working, you can get a call 15 minutes before the end of your shift.
Mm-hmm.
You're obligated to go, and then you return 2 or 3 hours later.
What is the determining factor on whether they choose to? I mean, I could think where obviously it's a remote location where there just doesn't happen to be an ambulance sitting around. Is it the remoteness of the location? Is it time? I'm guessing as a factor. If time is critical to saving this life, who makes that call whether to send up the helicopter or not?
typically it's when the ambulance arrives, we'll make that call. If there is an ambulance there, and there usually is way before we arrive, they'll make that call and go ahead and they'll go ahead and hire and signal for us to come.
In all the years you were doing this, did you ever have a situation where you and your crew were the first medical professionals on the scene?
You know, that's a really good question. I think there was one over in Safford when I first started. We got there before the ambulance did because of the remoteness, but then we had difficulty landing too. And, but we were there and we were first on scene. Yes. Even before the firefighters, they called 911 and they knew it was going to be a difficult transport. So.
Wow. Okay. Ladies and gentlemen, this is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're talking with Beth Ann Laus, who was one of those angels with rotors. We're talking about the life flights, a critical component in saving the lives of our neighbors out there. Stick around. We'll be right back. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio, ladies and gentlemen. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're talking about life flight, and if you're not familiar with that term, I'm sure you're familiar with them flying over your community. We're joined by Beth Ann Laus, who did this. Beth Ann, correct me if I'm wrong, for 8 years.
That is correct.
You were flying life flight. You, in the break, and I keep telling myself, sometimes we need to set up a separate part of the show where people can hear what we talk about on the commercial breaks. But you mentioned something that made me raise an eyebrow. I'm a big believer in the power of storytelling, and I asked you, well, do you have any good stories? And I was surprised by your answer. Share with us the oddest life flight rescue that you can think of.
Well, that consisted of myself. Actually, we owned a ranch down in Elgin, Arizona, and very remote ranch. It was an in-holding property, 16 miles from the border. We had several horses, very, very high performance horses. And my family that day had been in Tucson, went to Tucson early to, go ahead and go to school and work. And I stayed home that day and went down to feed the horses about 11:30 in the morning. The barn was about a quarter mile from the house, and I walked down, and which was not atypical. I went down there to feed the animals and went to go feed my daughter's one gelding, and one of our mare horses came behind me, charged me, and he thought the mare wanted his food, and he proceeded to kick me. And I was kicked once, and that was all it took. Double hoofed, I got, I shattered my ulna. In my radius, I had a small fracture to my left side of my pelvis. My left arm was shattered, and I had 3 fractured ribs from one kick. And now the story is, we had 7 horses. I continued to feed all the horses. I did not fall down. I did not fall to the ground. I had all my healers. I had 5 healer pups at that time. They were all around me, very worried about me because I know they knew they could sense it. And so then I go ahead and proceed to walk the quarter mile home because cell phones don't work out there. And I went to my ranch house. I called 911. I called my husband at that time. I don't remember any of this. And I remember an ambulance arriving. I don't remember anything more beyond that. And then the helicopter arrived and, you know, they couldn't get an IV started on me. Then they finally did. The nurse and the heliport transport started the IV and we went to UMC. And I went to surgery.
Now, were you a nurse at this time?
Absolutely. It was in 2012.
Okay, so let me ask this question. They always say a lawyer who represents himself as a fool for a client. Was it hard for you when they couldn't get an IV in to not just want to say, hey, I can do it,
Well, it was the firefighters from Sonoyta. They were fantastic, but they were so nervous because I was a nurse and they knew me. And, you know, I felt so bad, but they could not get, they tried 6 times to get an IV in me. And then when the nurse arrived on the heliport, she was successful first time out.
Well, you might have been one of their more calmer patients.
All I wanted was morphine, so I wanted to be very calm, actually.
Don't get kicked by a horse just to get morphine. A little safety tip out there. Beth Ann, when we talk to first responders, one of the messages I really try and emphasize for the general public out there to understand is whether you're a law enforcement officer or a firefighter or a trauma nurse or a trauma doctor, very often you're dealing with people on what's going to be one of the worst days of their life. How that's got to wear on you if you're experiencing. I mean, it's got to be great to come up with an accident and there's a child and you get in the hospital and you've saved, you've got to save. You can chalk that up. I saved a life. I did what I was supposed to do. But does that not, I mean, that's got to wear on a person over time, doesn't it?
Oh boy, yes, it does. And as you were talking, I started thinking of stories that just, you know, I'm not at liberty to talk about them, but I will say that the trauma and, you know, not knowing, it's like the firefighters, they never know what their next call is going to be. Well, mm-hmm. in life flight nursing, it's exactly the same. Probably, a little more intensified even because you're flying, you know, thousands of feet in the air in a little tin can and you can't hear. So, and then sometimes when we take care of these trauma patients, consider this, it's in the dark. There's no light. When it's at nighttime, there's no light and it's very difficult. And, you know, it can be scary. We fly in storms. I mean, just because monsoons hit, that doesn't mean we stop flying. And I had some close calls. It's just inherent in the nature of the business. When you fly, there are so many dangers, and then the trauma piece is another factor. I'll be honest with you, I shared with you during break, the reason I'm no longer a trauma nurse is because I started having severe anxiety about flying. 8 years, and I had, during that time, I had my three daughters who are now in their 20s, and I had them back to back. I had three of them in 4 years, and I started envisioning, and I started having these thoughts that if we crashed, I'd not see my kids again. So for 8 years I did it, but then I realized I had to do something different.
Well, and I tell you, when I was a firefighter, wildlands firefighter, very often we on occasion would use helicopters insertions on very remote fires, and very often I was one of the first ones to go because I'm so small they could, you know, as far as weight goes, they could put me and a chainsaw on a helicopter versus a normal sized person. And I'll never forget in the training there, Beth Ann, it's almost like a full day was just explained to us all the reasons why helicopters shouldn't fly and how they can just drop out of the sky. You know, and I don't know if they're trying to scare us or they're trying to just make us aware of the dangers of it. I mean, clearly, you know, if you have half a brain cell, you know, you don't approach it from, you know, the rear rotor side because that could end up being a very messy day. But, and I'm thinking about your line of work too, just the additional risk of being in an aircraft. You mentioned thunderstorms, and it's not, I don't want to say it's unusual, but I mean, we have had instances where those birds have gone down.
If you Google Arizona and lifelike crashes, there are, I mean, just before I walked in the door here, I Googled and 7 popped up, but there's way more than 7. There, you know, occasionally they'll have survivors, occasionally they won't. Many of them had the patients on board. And, you know, it's myriad of reasons they crashed, whether they crashed because of weather or, you know, the engines failed. Yeah. I mean, it is a fact, and it did wear on me after several years.
One of the things that my wife and I, we love watching, we binge watch these reality shows. I don't know if there's a life flight reality show. I'll have to look it up when I get home. But where I happen to live, sometimes the neighbors grouse about the noise of the helicopter coming into the hospital. I want to grab them by the collars and shake them and say, do you know what that helicopter means? That means that you, someone you know, or a neighbor, maybe not you, is having their life saved. You know, roll over and go back to sleep. Show a little bit of patience there. So, Beth Ann, we've just got a couple minutes left. I want to ask you, so who takes care of the caregivers in cases like this? I mean, are there, who takes care of people like you who've experienced this or are law enforcement officers or for other first responders? What can they do? What can we do for them?
You know, it's interesting you say that because now I'm in that line of work. That's what I do. I take care of first responders and help coach them through their difficult times. And, you know, and we all have trauma. I mean, trauma creates trauma. It's that simple, really. And how we deal with it and how we process it is really individualized as well. So, you know, how can we help? Well, we help by being involved in our communities. We help by understanding that, you know, when they retire, not always does their brain shut off. You know, it continues, and they think about the days that were really difficult and the moments that were really difficult. And we need to be understanding about that, but also letting them be heard and being, you know, and that's why professionals like myself are in the community, and we do help those individuals on a day-to-day basis.
Beth Ann, I will tell you honestly, I don't think you've been the best life flight recruiter here today. I'm just funning you because it is hard. But if someone, a young person out there listening, wants to pursue this career, what, I mean, besides the obvious, get your nursing degree and do this, what are some other things they need to think about?
Well, they need to think about their schedules and scheduling. I mean, scheduling is a big problem, and it can be if you have families. It's really a much more admirable job if you are single and you have a flexible schedule. Mm-hmm. You know, when you have a family, it's much more difficult.
And does this lead to potentially to other careers? I assume if I'm going to be a trauma nurse, I want to experience the hardest, toughest experiences I can, because that's going to help me help the next person.
Absolutely. I became the nurse manager at Tucson Medical Center during the time I was working Life Flight, and that was the reason I became that, had that role. And it was fantastic. I worked there for 6 years in that role, and it was dynamic, and it led me to, greater things in my career. But I worked for Tucson Orthopedic Institute and TMC, and it was the largest, orthopedic unit in the city of Tucson.
Well, Beth Ann, thank you so much for your time doing this, and thank you for what you're continuing to do to support supporting those who support us, for helping our first responders out there as you continue to be engaged and go forward. And let me just leave you with one quote. I pulled this off the interwebs from an interview with another Life Flight nurse, and she said, "You never give up on anybody. You don't declare them dead until God says they're dead."
Amen.
Amen. There you go, folks. Another great show. You can listen to this and other podcasts at AmericanWarriorRadio.com. Over 220 interviews with heroes like Beth Ann Louse. We also have a Facebook page. Follow us at American Warrior Radio and Twitter at Warrior Radio TUC. If you support what we're doing, we could use your help to spread the messages. Patreon.com/AmericanWarriorRadio. Until next time, all policies and procedures are to remain in place. Take care.
You've been listening to American Warrior Radio. You can hear over 150 episodes of this program at AmericanWarriorRadio.com.